This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Gentlemen, right here, right now, please welcome with Paul Blizzard, Simon Reeve.
Good afternoon, everybody. Quick question. See if you're still awake. How many of you were here at exactly this show, exactly this time, last year with this man? Good. Welcome back.
Oh, goodness me.
Last year, we were talking about Greece. How many of you saw the, Simon going around Greece? Wasn't it a brilliant piece of TV? Didn't you feel like you were there? And didn't you want to meet mad monk on a tractor with his handgun tucked into his cassock? You have gone a bit... Well, we're going to talk about a show that hasn't come out yet for a little bit. If we're allowed to, are we allowed to?
Don't know what you're going to say, but yes, I'm sure you are.
Turkey.
Right, yeah.
Why Turkey?
Why Turkey? Okay, hello, everybody. Hello. Thanks to those who've come back again. Goodness me. I have made, not on my own, as you probably gather, a couple of programmes about Turkey, a little series about Turkey called... Turkey, does what it says on the tin television, went on a journey around Turkey, big loop around. Why Turkey? Well, in some ways, Turkey is the most important country in the world, so why not, I suppose, would be the most obvious response. It's always been at the centre of world events. It's a bit of a cliche, but it's true. It's obviously the crossroads and connection between Europe and Asia. And that has led to issues, challenges, and opportunities for Turkey over the centuries. So we try and incorporate that into the show as well. We were planning to go before the failed coup last year and arrive just a couple of weeks after it had happened. And was naturally, I suppose, we were naturally concerned about how that would... impact on our filming. It felt obviously that the country was even more relevant than ever, but we thought, goodness me, they're going to, you know, stop us from doing things. People won't talk to us. But luckily, that wasn't the case. And to my surprise, you don't really see... It's quite hard to see a sense of the security build-up or the purge that's underway since the coup, which I'm sure you're all aware of. It's also quite hard even when you're right down... on the border between Syria and Turkey to see evidence of conflict on the other side or to see evidence of conflict in just inside Turkey, by which I mean the border there down here is a very clear line between chaos and catastrophe on one side and relative order on the other. So it was a reminder to me, like perhaps nowhere else I've been, of how a simple line on a map can... not just decide fate, but decide utter lives. It's extraordinary and terrifying, really. What side of the border you're on obviously decides survival or annihilation. And we were on the border. We could hear artillery, the thud. That's not a very good... Sort of this thud of artillery in the distance as artillery was hitting Aleppo just to the south. And where we were, there were farmers ploughing their fields. That's a sort of... situation you can get where chaos one side, normality on the other. Frightening, really, in many ways, but it's worth us remembering that, I think.
Frightening, but in highly defined areas, so it shouldn't put people off going to Turkey this summer for their holidays, whether it's on the beautiful south coast that everybody knows so well or whether to Istanbul, yes?
No, I think... Sorry?
Are you all right?
No, I've got a slightly dodgy knee, thank you for asking. I have to keep stretching it out. It's proving slightly problematic, actually, seeing as it's only a pain when it's in a sort of right, L-shaped right angle like that, which I spend a lot of my time like that, cramped up in vehicles, planes and trains. So I'm constantly having to put my leg between the two front seats and stick it on somebody's lap. There's probably laws against it, an industrial tribunal in the offing. But anyway, no, I definitely don't think people should be... I don't think people should be put off from going almost anywhere on this planet because travel and the connection that we make when we go away is so fundamental, perhaps more fundamental now than ever. And I think actually the fact so many of us have gone on the move and we have experienced other cultures, lived in, loved other cultures, is part of the reason why actually now is part of the reason why now is the safest time ever to be alive. You know, your chances of dying in armed conflict now are lower than any time in the history of us. So when we are thinking about the challenges that many of our kith and kin are facing on this planet, let's at least remember this is the best time there's ever been to be a human. So you shouldn't be put off from going to Turkey. You shouldn't be put off from going anywhere. You don't really see, as I was alluding to, you don't really see evidence of the crises that are affecting Turkey. And they are. Let's not dispute that. There is obviously a political crisis there. There was an attempted coup, for goodness sake. There is war raging in Syria next door. Nobody can ignore that. There is an economic crisis in the brewing there. There is, of course, a refugee crisis because Turkey has done more than any other country to host an enormous number of Syrian refugees. Nearly 3 million refugees have found sanctuary in Turkey. So we should doff the cap to that. They've done incredibly on that. As a tourist, if you don't want to see that, you don't have to. I would urge you not to avoid it. You're all adventurous travellers. You're here at the destination show, after all. I would say that taking an interest in the problems and challenges facing other countries is only something that makes your journey and your experience more interesting when you're in a country. It only educates you and informs you and gives you more memories as a result. So it's a powerfully important thing that you ask questions when you're somewhere, where you take an interest, where you don't shy away from the problems facing a country or a people. Don't ignore it. You don't have to, and it will give you a more memorable experience, I think. That's not to say you should be a sort of culture, a sort of a travel vulture observing disaster, like some war junkie or anything like that. But don't feel that you have to shy away from it. People don't mind you asking questions and taking an interest. I think the surprise for me on my journeys, or the biggest surprise since I started, has been how warm and welcoming and hospitable almost everyone is on this planet, and how keen people are to share stories of their lives, their experiences, their culture, their faith, and their tragedies as well sometimes. And let's not shy away from it. But for the long answer.
Let's not do trauma tourism.
I don't think so. I mean, I think trauma tourism, I'm not entirely, nobody's ever really defined it, I think people turning up and sort of parasitically leeching off communities is obviously very dodgy. But at the same time, people going somewhere to a tricky part of the world, taking an interest, and then going home and sharing what they've learned is powerful and important.
That's proper travelling, is what it's
called. It is. That's why people have been doing it since we became sentient and started moving on two legs.
Since we left the Great Rift Valley and headed north. What is it?
Let's go deep. Let's go back in history
back,
here.
Exactly. now, listen, there are a couple of things you taught me about Turkey from having seen bits
already?
And pieces of it.
Brilliant.
Yeah, no, exactly. One of which is from what's called, halal tourism. Can you tell us what halal tourism is?
Yes.
And why it's having an impact on Turkey?
Yes, so the world's changing, obviously, and different peoples and communities are going on the move. We all know now, for example, obviously Brits have been travelling in large numbers for a couple of... only for a couple of decades. When I was a kid, I didn't get on a plane until I started working. My first proper holidays or trips abroad when I was an adult. So it's a couple of decades now since we've been travelling extensively. The Chinese, obviously, are now travelling in large numbers. There is a new tourism movement dedicated, really, to catering to Chinese tourists around the world because they're a huge travel industry and market. There is an emerging market now that's known as halal-friendly tourism for Muslim travellers. So the hotels will have had specially adapted features. Obviously, that can boil down to no pork and no alcohol, which some of the hotels are very... pleased to do because it lowers their costs quite a lot. And that's a big market now in Turkey. And I think it's really interesting that this is happening in Turkey particularly because Turkey is this crossroads between different cultures. And it appeals to both European travellers, it appeals to travellers from the Middle East. It tries to project different faces to different communities. Sometimes it does that successfully. Sometimes it feels like a little bit of a contradiction. But Turkey has now... for a long time been told that it has to make a choice between looking to the east for its inspiration and looking to the West. So it's been told, Turkey, you've got to make a decision. Are you a European nation or are you a Middle Eastern country? And Turkey, I think now, and it's a bit risky me saying this because I haven't fully written this part of the script because we're still working on the programmes, but the sense I really have is that Turkey has decided it's going to choose its own path, that it doesn't have to choose the European way or the Middle Eastern way. It's going to take the best and sometimes the worst of both, but it's going to do its own thing, basically. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens because, can't stress this enough, strategically, politically, culturally, Turkey is absolutely vital, not just to the security of Europe in the Middle East, but the wider world, the Islamic world as well. So we should keep an eye on it. We should keep an interested eye on it.
One of the things I really love about your shows and the way that you present and research the shows that you do is that you take us right into the heart of place, like all good travel writers, and you're, let's not forget, as good a travel writer as you are as a travel presenter. But you always find, you do this magnificent thing, which is you find the stories of the people who live in the country, because of course there are 6.5 million destinations here on this world, and they're the people that we meet when we're travelling. Mm. Your line from yesterday, in fact. But there was a guy that runs a B&B in Turkey that was particularly stunning. Tell us a little bit about him.
Happily. In fact, I was watching him last night because we're editing these two Turkey programmes at the moment, and I was seeing a final cut of the show. It just makes me smile when you think of him, which might sound terribly narcissistic. I'm not smiling at myself. I'm just smiling at this chap, Metin, who runs a bed and breakfast in the Black Sea Mountains in Turkey, which I would thoroughly urge you all to visit. Not at the same time, because I'm not sure he could cope, but really, you should head there. Metin has a bed and breakfast in the mountains. Gorgeous and glorious at the same time. It's a glorious part of the world, it really is. If you haven't been, and not many foreign and outsiders have, and you really, really should go, because goodness me, it's a little bit like the Canadian Rockies, but with a more interesting variety of trees, I would say. So, incredible forested mountains, and on one of them lives Metin. Now, what is particularly interesting about Metin, apart from the fact he is a sort of woodsman who lives a fairly remote and humble life, is he lives on the one side of a valley, and your vehicle can get to the other side of the valley, and then the challenge is how you get to Metin's bed and breakfast. And the way Metin has decided to do it, rather than building a road, is he has built a half-kilometre-long zip wire across this valley with a drop underneath it of 400 metres, which, believe you me, is a long way down. And he has created a homemade zip wire to take visitors and adventurous travellers, I present them to you, Metin, across the valley. And he built, well, he got somebody in the town to build a steel crate that was strong enough. He said it had to be strong enough to carry a cow across, so it can manage me and a couple of my heavy bags. And that takes you at a fair old lick across the valley as you cling slightly, somewhat nervously to the sides and question, did Metin actually say he had an engineering qualification or not? He doesn't, but many have done this route and it hasn't failed yet.
Is it terrifying? Are you scared of heights?
I actually do get vertigo, right. And I have been in several situations where we have had filming problems due to me being slightly nervous being on a stage or two rungs up a ladder or something. I remember we were in Egypt, and we were filming at the, what's it called, the Nile Marker. Who's been to it? It's an ancient building, the Nile, Nilometer, I think it's actually called. And we had a security guard with us. He was more like a professional Egyptian Special Forces bodyguard. He travelled the whole way with us. But the most important thing he did was guide me down these terribly narrow steps, if you did them, down into the depths of this Nilometer, using that sort of, look at me, the eyes, look at me, like this. Sorry to look at you, madam. But that was his most important thing. He managed to get me down these very narrow steps without looking down the side. That takes me back to it. Oh, that still gives me the heebie-jeebies.
And yet you've zoomed around in microlights and helicopters and good as those ones.
Helicopters I'm fine in. I don't know why. Helicopters, balloons, microlights, except when they do a sort of corkscrew,
right,
which happened to me when I was in on Crete filming in Greece, and we went, you know, with mad ideas, you know. Let's go up in a microlight sort of thing to have a look at the island, get a sense of it. You only really understand it when you're up in the air. And it's kind of true, but it's a slightly hackneyed phrase we've used. Anyway, and the bloke I was with, we'd been saying to him, look, don't do anything silly. And you can't hear it because we've bleeped it out of the programme. But there's a point in the Grease programmes where he started corkscrewing around, and all you can hear me saying is completely unrepeatable words that are totally unacceptable for a family audience. So we had to cut that down, and you can see me sort of punching him to level the plane out. Anyway, sorry.
Even in mainstream TV, no one can hear you scream.
No. Well, they can hear me scream, that's for sure. Just not swearing is
exactly.
It's not very acceptable. But helicopters, no, they're not too bad. I was in a Black Hawk helicopter. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
No, go on, carry on with that story.
Well, no, I was in a... I've just come back from Colombia. I mean, nobody is more surprised that I'm going around the map than me. I'm very lucky, and I do accept the privilege of my gig. I am amazed that I've been allowed to do it. But I've just been filming in Colombia, and Colombia is extraordinary. If you haven't been, you want to start thinking, because people are going to start flooding in there because they've had a peace deal, the security is much better there, the tourist infrastructure is going, it's a gorgeous place, glorious place. And we were seeing some of the darkness as well. So we went and on a raid of an illegal gold mine with about 150 very heavily armed Colombian troops. And I'm just suddenly remembering we were in this Black Hawk helicopter traveling with these Colombian special forces. And you have to sit in a very intimate way with these massive burly blokes, sort of each one of you squatting between the legs in the helicopter. The doors are open at one point. The helicopter does a bit of a tip, and everybody has to link arms, otherwise we fall out. So, and then I'm fine with that, but just slight state. Oh no, it's a bit of a vertigo. Vertigo is a killer for me, but normally when I'm on solid ground.
I may not be allowed to talk about this, or you may not be.
I'm sure you are.
But can I try? Because your trip back from Colombia was interesting in the post-Trump world and getting an American visa. How many of you have applied for an ESTA, the online visa application service for the United States, since Trump took office? Tell us why it's now much more difficult.
No, I don't think it's because of Trump. I think... But basically, we were chatting away, as you do, having a chat before, and I was saying that I haven't been allowed to travel through American airspace, even in transit. So we applied when I was coming back from Colombia for me to get an ESTA, which is a sort of visa waiver so you can transit through the States. I know you all know this. And anyway, so mine has not been approved in the post 9/11 world because I've been to, well, in truth, I've been to almost all of the dodgy countries that the Americans are worried about. So when they started saying, you haven't been to Libya, the Congo, but Somalia, Sudan. Yes, I have been to those. It's for filming, for goodness sake. But, you know, so I'm effectively disallowed from American airspace, from transiting through Miami Airport at the moment. So get your applications in early. Or, you know, if they're not going to let us in, go somewhere more interesting. I mean, I love America, but they need to make it a little bit easier, don't they?
I think so. So we're not going to be seeing Simon Reeve does east to west coast continental coasts of America.
Well, I'm nervous at you even saying that, in case anybody's listening. Don't say that, because it's a good idea.
It is a good
idea. And obviously I would apply for a visa in a proper procedure several years in advance if somebody puts that idea forward. Thank you, Paul.
You're welcome. Listen, there are more countries that you have been to than you haven't been to. Here's how to phrase this. Can you give us any insights as to what your level of travelling? You get to go to places that most people don't get to get to, that very few meet people that very few people get to meet. What has it taught you about the art of travelling? What has it taught you about the state of the world that we're in, which is what travelling is all about?
Rabbit in headlights. What's it taught me about travel and the state of the world we're in? Goodness.
I don't mean to throw you a curveball, but you're
I like
an intelligent
man. You're always sort of nudging me and going like this, hurry up with your answers. How am I meant to answer that in a short way? I will have a go. I have been to a lot of countries. I feel very blessed to have done that. There's almost 200 proper countries, but just because you've been to Brazil once doesn't mean you've done Brazil.
Of course.
Now, I haven't been, there's still a lot of places I haven't been to, there's a lot of places I'd love to go back to. It's an enormous world with endless stories, obviously. I think the way I'm going to interpret that
as a
question is to maybe just talk about how we are encouraged to travel and how I would encourage you to travel. Not that I'm sure most of you need it, but I think there is a risk in the travel industry that we are just transported from point A to point B and encouraged to sit by the swimming pool and drink the drinks in the primary colours. And I think that is not the most rewarding experience. I sense that most of you do not go for that experience and that you want something richer and more rewarding. And I think we have to sort of fight back against that option, because it is seductive and it is alluring. And when the sun is out, I do work very hard. I could do with a rest here. No, get up, get out, go and eat in some crazy local restaurants. Drink some drinks your grandchildren or your grandparents wouldn't approve of. Meet crazy local people. Ask them questions. Have experiences. That is obviously what we need to be doing. If you ask the travel companies for that, you know they want to give you what you want. So if you ask for it, they will give it to you. But their natural inclination is to cosset you, keep you safe, and milk you like a cash cow. So you've got to rage against that and get out of the gated resort, find the way out, and go and have proper experiences. And the further you go off the beaten track, you know the richer and the more rewarding experience you will have. I think probably most of you know that already. Forgive me for stating the obvious. But I think travel has still got, in terms of what I've learned, we are everywhere. Humans are everywhere. There aren't really any unique places to discover. I've been very, very lucky to have been to small, remote communities which haven't seen an outsider before. And that's an extraordinary experience and a responsibility as well. Those places are very few and very far between. That shouldn't put us off, because there are still extraordinary and memorable experiences to have out there. So don't stop traveling because other people have been there before you, for goodness sake. But travel in a different way. Travel with your eyes wider open and more open to the craziness of life in other places, and embrace it. You know, I think, frankly, Michael Palin's been showing us the way for a while, that abroad is not alien, that foreigners are not weird. They do not eat strange, crazy food. They eat food that's generally more interesting than ours. So embrace and enjoy is the main thing I would say, and you can still have incredible experiences out there.
Most
pick me up on that if that's a rubbish answer.
No, I think it's absolutely right. I think it's the right message to say.
Very squeaky chair.
Probably why everybody said it's a very irritating...
I'll bring WD-40 tomorrow if I remember. I can't sit still. I've had a cup of tea.
Listen, we're running out of time. There's a couple of things I want to touch on. Most of your career, TV career, that you see on the screen, it strikes me, it involves beautiful, clear blue seas, wonderful blue skies, quite a lot of tropical rain, rather nice warm places.
It's been a tough gig.
And then suddenly, you're in the middle of the Arctic doing Arctic Live.
Yes. Well, the Arctic wasn't the problem. The live bit was a bit of a challenge, but...
how many of you here saw Simon Reeve doing Arctic Live with Kate?
Yeah. Two or three. Thank you. It was a very British there with the hands. Yeah, I know.
How did it come about? What was it for?
It came about, I was asked to do it, and it sounded like a fantastic idea. About half the stuff I've done has been my idea, and half is put to me now, which is fantastic. You know, it's lovely for people to come up and say, what do you think of this? I mean, I'm so lucky. I feel completely blessed. I know it won't last forever, but anyway. Anyway, so three presenters, myself and two professionals, were called on for this gig. Gordon Buchanan, Kate Humble, who helmed it. And the idea was, we go to the Arctic, we went to Churchill. Who's been to Churchill? In northern Canada, come on, I know several of you will have been. Yes, lucky you. So this is the polar bear capital of the world, for those who are unfamiliar with it. Reason being, it might be hidden behind the screen there, but reason being, can I attempt this? Don't be silly, come on. So reason being, it's on the migratory route for polar bears as they head out onto Hudson Bay. As Hudson Bay freezes over, bears go out to hunt seals. And humans have somewhat foolishly built a small town in their path. And, of course, now they make a lot of money from the tourists who turn up. Polar bears do as well, though, as we discovered. And we try to film that. We try to show you a bit of Arctic life up there in the frozen north, why it matters, why it's important, why the polar bears are incredible. And we also filmed in a couple of other places throughout the Arctic region as well. So I went to Greenland, northern Norway, northern Russia as well. Makes me smile thinking about it, actually. It's incredible trips. Greenland was one of the most amazing places I've ever been to, like visiting another planet, frankly. And we made it, wrapped it up into one program. It was broadcast live from Churchill, the first proper live TV I've done, and never mind the vertigo, when there's a voice counting down in your ears telling you you're about to go live to one or two people and your five-year-old son watching back in Blighty, that's nerve-wracking, honestly. My wife sent me a picture, actually, after about 10 or 15 minutes of my five-year-old sitting in front of the telly watching me. And apparently he turned to mummy and he said, "Mummy, Daddy's doing really well. He hasn't said anything stupid yet." I thought, well, that's not too bad then, and I turn up for the books.
Out of the mouths of babes. Yeah. Just tell us briefly about Greenland. Have anybody here been to Greenland? It is an extraordinary.
Of course they have. Oh, it's destination.
Tell us what you made of Greenland, because it's not that popular a destination.
No, it's not.
Not that widely known.
It's well advertised in name, though, of course. Eric the Red, I think, who tried to encourage other settlers to turn up there by mislabeling it. It's covered, or most of it's covered, by an extraordinary sheet of ice. That's generally how it's described. In reality, it is more like an enormous block of ice, a reservoir of ice, more than, on average, a mile thick. It is one of the largest stores of drinkable water on this planet, frankly. And it is melting, inevitably, as we warm our planet. The Arctic is heating faster than anywhere else. This block of ice is colossal. It isn't just thick, it's vast as well, many times the size of France, for example. So you get up into Greenland, and if you're very lucky like me, you go out on an ice patrol in a helicopter that zips around, and you see the side of this ice block, and you start to realize what Mother Nature is truly capable of on this planet, and how tiny and insignificant we are. And you realize, goodness me, this is like almost like an emergency break-the-button store of energy and water, that if we screw up our planet too much, that block of ice melts, the sea level rises, and perhaps not us in Blighty, but many cultures around this world are going to take an absolute hammering. So it's a real reminder of the raw power of our planet. Apart from all that else there is to see there, the muskox, the extraordinary wildlife, the native people as well, the indigenous people of Greenland. It's a fascinating place to go. Loved it.
One of the destinations that I know you're a huge fan of, tell us why you love Bangladesh.
Okay, left field, yes. I do love Bangladesh. Right, yes, thank you for remembering. So I love countries which aren't perhaps just obviously tourist destinations, but that's not entirely true, because I did really love the Maldives as well, actually. But I love Bangladesh. So Bangladesh would be in my top five countries in the world, without a doubt. Why? It's poor. Yes, it's packed. Yes. I've said this a few times. Sorry if you've heard it before. But it's very special. The people there are probably the biggest draw for me, because they exist at the very edge of what's possible for humans to endure. But they are feisty, they are passionate, they get very antsy if they're not happy, frankly. Like most people in Bengalis generally, if they're not happy about something that the government's done, they go out on strike, they vote for somebody else, they lead a march, they get agitated. And I love that, because so many places around the world, I get really frustrated about how apathetic a lot of people can be. And I know it's not the done thing for BBC people to incite rebellion and revolt, but sometimes, you know, you just want to lead a march and get a bit angry. But Bengalis and Bangladeshis particularly, they do it for you, so love them for it. I've had some amazing experiences there, on the edge of existence almost, but with people who are very, very special. Can I tell you a story I don't think I've told you before? It might make me cry.
It's your show.
No, it's definitely not. But so just to give you, it's when you say about Bangladesh, it's always one of my key reminders of the potential of our brothers and sisters and cousins on this planet who weren't born with the advantages we have. And sorry if I start a little blubbing, but just don't worry about me, I'll be all right. But basically, when I filmed in Bangladesh, I filmed there several times with a guy called Tanjil, who's an amazing, inspiring sort of a fixer, as we would call it. He's like a producer on the ground. And he's got a massive beard, wiry head of hair, skinny as a rake, force of nature, extraordinary charismatic guy. And he came to see me for lunch, dinner actually, in London a while back. And he was really late. And I said to him, you know, Tanjil, you're so late. What happened? He said, oh, I'm so sorry. I was coming up the road and I had a phone call. I said, all right, don't worry. He said, let me tell you a story. And he said, about a couple of decades ago, he'd been leading a different film party on a trip into the Sundarbans region of Bangladesh, which is one of the largest mangrove areas in the world. And they were on a big houseboat with a little galley and a chef and things like that. And they were going to film man-eating tigers in the mangrove. So it was all a bit dangerous. And they stopped in a very, very, very remote village. And the chef went out to get supplies. And he came back and he said, hey, Tanjil, this is going to be quite a hard trip. There's a boy in the village who is enslaved. He's shackled to pay off a family debt. Can we pay the debt for $20 or whatever it was? And can I get him on the boat and have him as a helper? He'll be really useful. And Tanjil said, no, we're going to do something really dangerous here. Let's just stick with it. We don't need anybody. And the chef says, please, I'll look after him. He won't be a problem. And so Tanjil said yes. And they took him on the boat and they gave him some food, took the shackle off and gave him some clothes and so on. And so we're sitting in London talking about this. And I say, oh, it's really interesting, Tanjil. And Tanjil sort of sits back and I say, why were you late? What's that got to do with being late? And Tanjil says, that was the boy on the phone. And he is now one of the world's leading tiger conservation experts. And he was calling Tanjil from Nepal, where he was setting up a tiger sanctuary. Gets me every single time I think of that. And when we're on our journeys, you'll probably have a similar example to that, but that is just one of many examples of somebody who is incredible, who wasn't born with the advantages we have. And when we are in these extraordinary places, you talk to people. They have got that potential. They have got that capability. So talk to them, hear their stories, learn their lives, and remember, I'm sure you've got your own lad like that who's got a similar story to that, but goodness me, it's an extraordinary time to be travelling and meeting people like that, engaging with people like that, and I've met other people like that elsewhere in the world. That, for me, is the beauty of living now and being able to travel the way we can. So anyway, sorry, that is one of many reasons I love travel and Bangladesh.
Hell of a story. Well, the reason I was mentioning Bangladesh is, of course, if the Greenland ice cap does melt, Bangladesh is in trouble because it's so low-lying.
It is. There is not a single bit of rock in the entire country. It's all formed, really, by silt coming off the Himalayas. Exactly. So, yes.
Extraordinary place.
It's at the edge of what we can exist in.
And a hell of a place to go to. Right. We have a man here called Roddy. He has a microphone. If you stick your hand up,
the voice of
he'll
God,
point it right. at you and you get to ask your own question of Simon.
Hi, Simon. As you know, I've been here a few times before.
Thank you for coming again.
And I just wanted to say there have been so many dramas, crime dramas with Nordicana and the Scandinavian crime dramas, but there have been very few programmes about Scandinavia. Would you actually consider sort of doing a TV series in an unusual way across Scandinavia? And when can we expect the Turkey series to come out?
Thank you for both of those. I love the idea of travelling in Scandinavia. I think generally I have stuck to regions and countries that have got darkness and light. So they've got real challenges and utter glory. Now, I love Scandinavia. My wife is half Danish. We go to Denmark a fair bit. It's at the opposite extreme for a lot of the countries I go to because it's so well run. It's so ordered. I like it, but some people there obviously go, don't you find it a little less challenging? I'm being polite, but still less challenging than some of the places. Yeah, it can be, but obviously, like everywhere, you look for what's fascinating and what's extraordinary about it. I'm sure we could find it in Scandinavia. If the BBC want me to go there, I am totally up for it. When is Turkey coming out? Turkey is probably, I'd say 2 months, or the end of, where are we now, beginning of February, probably the end of March, I would imagine. But they never tell me these things. I don't get to decide that. So it's all quite last minute. I haven't done the voiceover for either programmes, and we might end up doing it quite close to the broadcast. Just two programmes for that.
Here's your show idea, the rise of uber nationalism in Scandinavia. So there's your darkness in the land of the
midnight. Yeah, that's true. In fact, motorcycle gangs as well are a big problem. There. So yes.
Right.
File that away, Simon. Yeah, all
good
right.
Good question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen there, please. Just pointed out your mouth.
Hi, Simon.
Hello.
I'd be most interested to know how your wife and son handle your continual habits of being away.
Ah. Yes.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know that as well.
What does your wife say when you come home?
And
what does she say when you leave?
It's a tricky thing for me. I think my wife manages fine. She's half Danish. They're ludicrously practical, and I think she's probably quite glad to get rid of me whinging and complaining around the house. My son, I've only got one son, and I love him more than anything on this planet, and I miss him desperately when I'm away. And he's not great at interacting with me on the phone, so that can be quite frustrating. He's 5 at the moment. I think he understands this is what I do. I'm not going off for 6 months, you know, to be an aid worker, for goodness sake. I'm a telly presenter. There are much more rigorous, tougher gigs out there, and I really do genuinely know that. When I'm back, I'm generally back, and I'm able to, you know, take him to school now and again and pick him up, which he hates. But so I think he acknowledges it, but it's my son who's the issue, I think. And he does say, I wish Daddy was here a bit more often. And then that does bring a little tear to both our eyes. It's not as bad as one of the cameramen I've worked with. He had 2 sons, and he was away much more than I am. His sons, he remembers once, they built a wall of boxes in front of the front door to try and stop him from leaving, and each held onto one ankle to stop him going, and he still left. I mean, goodness, what a heartless individual. But, you know, it's the gig, it's the job, and there are much tougher ones out there, so they understand what the work is. They know it's not... they know the job is good, but they know it's not a holiday.
Can I quickly flip the question? Do you ever get homesick when you're travelling?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All the time.
Yep.
I love our little island. I think it's much underrated, frankly. I love all us bonkers Brits. And really, when we go away, we often say, look, we need some crazy eccentrics like we find in Blighty. You know, that's what we really want. So, yeah, I absolutely get homesick for the people and the place, and obviously family and friends more than anything.
Another question.
But at the same time, travel is amazing, isn't it?
Yes. Even if you've come to Olympia. Really? No other questions for Simon?
All right, let's go.
Yeah,
all right, sir.
No gentleman there. Brilliant. Gentleman with the beard and the dark jacket. Thank you, sir.
Hypothetically, sir, you're only allowed to travel in the next 15 years north or south of the Arctic and Antarctic circles, or within a very short distance of the equator. You have a choice.
I'd stick to the equator, I think. So you give me the choice between cold and hot. Yes? I'd go with hot. And I think the reason is I've been incredibly lucky. So I've travelled around the Tropic of...
equator.
Thank you very much. Yeah, equator. I've travelled the Tropic of Cancer around the planet, and I've travelled the Tropic of Capricorn. So I know that part of the world pretty well, I would claim, for a bloke from Acton. I think this is the most interesting part of our planet. It's home to so much of the poverty and conflict in our world, but it's home to incredible biodiversity. And you take, you know, just a small couple of acres of the Congo or Brazil or Madagascar, what you will find there in terms of flora and fauna is unlike anything we in Europe can really comprehend. I mean, we've got, 33 native trees in this country? Thousands in an acre or 2 acres in Madagascar or the Congo. So the level of complexity and biodiversity there is incredible. And it's a fascinating part of the planet. I love travelling around. Those are my 3 really epic journeys, I would say. And they mark a very distinct climactic, political, cultural region of the world. And just to roll on, sorry, but I think there is a real value to, I mean, listen to me saying this, but forgive me for it. Doing something like following a line or tracking a river from source to sea is something I really recommend, because it really, you know, following this line, this, for example, the equator, it forced us to go to parts of the world tele crews don't go, foreigners don't go, outsiders don't visit. And that meant we saw snatches of life that, well, they'll live here and here forever. So as a style of travel, if you like, I really recommend it. But I'd stick with the tropics, and I'd probably try and do those journeys again if you twist my arm and take my passport. Thanks for the question.
A couple of quick questions. Do we have any more questions? Then I'll ask... Oh, yes, we have a lady over there. While we're going to her, is there anything that you always take on a trip with you?
I've got a kit list that is about 17 pages long.
If you could take...
And it's the only work... Probably a head torch.
Yeah.
Head torch is about the most essential bit of kit. That saved my life on a few occasions. I was saying, yes, the water filter bottle, all of us should be taking one of those nowadays. You really shouldn't be drinking plastic water that's been sat in a plastic bottle in 50 degree heat for 47 months. You really don't want that. But, you know, I've got a long list of... This has become like a comfort blanket that I take everywhere, my shimeg.
Yeah, exactly.
So I've got several of those I take around. They're very useful in the hot parts and the cold, actually. But, you know, flapjacks, Leatherman in different sizes, goodness me, Mozzie net, the sprays, the pills, the kit, the bags, the cases. Oh, it's just all becomes a bit much. I'm always packing or unpacking, it feels like. Sorry, there was a question.
Question for the lady there.
Hi.
Flapjacks. Did I say flapjacks?
You did.
Sorry if this comes out really loud. Do you ever get to go away with your wife and son?
You're making me feel so guilty about being away from them, not taking them away enough. I do. We're not... We travel, but we're not... We haven't been going really long haul with my lad, partly because I think he wouldn't enjoy it adequately enough yet. He's more at the stage of enjoying the packaging rather than the present, if you know. But he is now starting to say, you know, how come Daddy gets to go on all the adventures? And he wants a little bit of it. So it will happen. I am keen. I just don't want to push him into it, because then that could put him off. But we've generally... My wife speaks fluent Greek. So she's always been going to Greece since she was a kid. She was luckier than I with the foreign holidays when she was young. So we go back to Greece a lot. We go to Simi. Who's been to Simi? Do you actually know Simi? Of course, the hands go up. Good, I'm delighted to see. What about you, whether you enjoyed it? I think it's one of the most beautiful islands. It's not covered in forests. It's a little bit dry, but it's got an incredible harbour. Probably the finest harbour, I would say, in Greece. S-Y-M-I, if anybody looks it up. So we go there a fair bit. Denmark, obviously, as I was saying, to see the in-laws. But it is time we started taking him a little bit further. And we are thinking of Costa Rica for somewhere to start introducing him to the wonders of the world. I want him to see and have the experiences that I've been very blessed to have as an adult. But I want him to really understand it and enjoy it. Because I do think it's a privilege and a responsibility to go away now. And we shouldn't just take it for granted. We should really use the opportunities as best we can. Really get the most out of it. So that's what I want for him. Thank you for reminding me.
Well, good question. One last question for me to wrap up. Mm. Of all the places you've been to, growing family, where, if you had to up sticks and move from Britain, is there anywhere you visited that you think you could actually live or would like to live, rather than just going in, filming and coming out again?
Yeah, and the going in and leaving is a very true aspect. I said earlier about how the danger of parasitically going in somewhere, and I feel sometimes we do that as a TV crew. You know, we're not putting down roots. We're turning up somewhere, we're hearing people's stories, and then we move on pretty quickly. It's very rare that we stay somewhere long enough to hang our shirts up in a cupboard. That's usually my definition for the fact that we've been somewhere too long, in truth. But if I was staying... the missus and I talked about Greece as somewhere to live, and I have thought once or twice about making a teleseries. We'd call it something like the perfect place to live, or the perfect place to get old, to be young, to have children, to be ill, to be healthy, whatever. And Greece ticks a lot of those boxes. I completely recognise that they have not been fiscally prudent, shall we say, although that was partly, a lot of that was Germany's fault. But I love Greece. I adore the Greeks as passionate and nationalistic and as lovable and as wonderful as they are, as infuriating as they can be sometimes. I feel like I can say that because I've got a lot of Greekophiles in the family, and I have travelled quite a lot around there filming a series about Greece as well. So Greece, I think, would be a fair old choice. It's an extraordinary place. It's just at the end of the Med. It's still exotic. It's still different. If you love Greece or you've been to Greece and you haven't been for Greek Easter, you need to go because it's a totally different experience. Too many people go at the end of the summer when things are very dry and the water's warm, I grant you. But if you go in springtime and you get this explosion of green and wildflowers and incredible festivals, so it's really exotic and a great place to go and live. And the food!
And just remind us, when do we get to see Turkey on our screens?
I think that will probably be end of March. Thank you for asking. And Colombia, I'm not sure. I actually haven't got a clue when that will be on, to be honest.
You're still working on it. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been fantastic. Enjoy the rest of the exhibition.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you for your questions.
Thank you to Paul as well.
But thank you to this lovely man, Simon Reeve.
Thank you, Paul.
Bless you, man.